Welcome and good evening. My name is Professor Michael Cox of the Department of International Relations here at the LSE. Welcome to this the Ralph Miliband lecture, and welcome to our speakers and welcome to you. The discussion tonight is, of course, a critical debate about the nature of globalization. For those seriously interested, by the way, looking back historically, and I was thinking about some few words to introduce this, in the study of international relations before 1989, and before the collapse of the Soviet Union, really only one thing was important, and that one thing was the Cold War, the Third Great War of the 20th century, or the Great Contest, as was once referred to by Isaac Deutscher. And there were two things people were never interested in then. I can remember because I was there. The first thing most people who studied real international relations were not interested in, they weren't interested much in international political economy. Perhaps one of the very few people at that stage who thought that economics was about strategy and about security, of course, was one of the former professors of this university, Susan Strange. But for most of us, of course, economics or international political economy was what people who couldn't do economics proper did. Namely, economists who couldn't add up became international political economists. The second thing people didn't talk about, and the word they never used, and I frankly can't ever remember the word ever being used, was globalization. Being a kind of a nerd who kind of surveys websites, I went back and found out how many times the word globalization appeared in titles of books in the 1970s and the 1980s. Lots of other words appeared, like integration and interdependence, but you won't find the word globalization. I found actually a couple of articles and one or two books with the term globalization before 1989. Well, how life changed after 1989 and 1991. As one of the critics of the globalization thesis has put it, globalization in the 1990s in the post-Cold War era became the zeitgeist of that particular epoch. And the debates thereafterwards were defined very much around the issue of globalization. How old was it? When did it begin? What did it mean for international relations? And in fact, did it mean the end of the state and the withering away of the state? For some of those old Leninists who always believed in the withering away of the state, at last, the state was withering away, but not for the reasons that old Leninists thought that it should. It was withering away under the impact of globalization. And so for literally 10 or 15 years, one could say, globalization became the dominant motif, the dominant theme of those studying international relations. Since 9/11, however, many would argue that once again it has gone off the agenda. 9/11, the war on terror, the focus on American power has pushed it off the academic, if not of the real world, agenda. So in some ways, in many ways, I think it's extremely important for the debate tonight, because the death of globalization has been announced too soon to say, and we shall see why tonight. The debate continues. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce two of those who have been central to the debate on globalization throughout the 90s and in the difficult days since 9/11, when people thought it had gone again, two speakers who are going to debate the whole issue of the meaning and nature of globalization. To go first will be Martin Wolf, who has written in defense of globalization in a powerful argument in why globalization works. And Martin will speak for 20, 25 minutes, to be followed by David Held, who's written more wisely and more regularly on this topic, I think, than anybody else. And I emphasize the wisdom rather than the regularity on this issue. So with no further ado from me, I welcome Martin from the Financial Times to open the discussion, a critical debate about the nature of globalization. Martin, you're most welcome at the London School of Economics. Martin, over to you.
All I can say is David has a more difficult billing to live up to than I do. It's a great pleasure to be here. I am stunned, and I truly mean stunned, by the number of people here, and even the fact that many people were turned away. I presume this is because you're all expecting to enjoy a spectacle similar to a bullfight. And I have little doubt about who here is present as the bull. And we all know what happens to the bull. I was delighted to accept this invitation, though I have to say somewhat surprised. I have at least one legitimate reason for being here, which is I actually met Ralph Miliband and also read, I think, if I remember correctly, a book called The Future of Socialism. Is that right? Somebody will correct me on that. But Ralph, of course, was a Marxist, which I never was. And at the time I met him, I was what we then called a Gaitskellite, which is a position well to the left of the position his sons have now adopted. So I suppose the fact that I'm here from my position addressing this subject has a certain suitability and indicates something about the way political opinions have moved over the last 40 years or so. Before I set out what I want to say out of this vast topic in 20, 25 minutes, I'm just going to cover a few aspects, as it were, giving David something to shoot at. Let me just say where I start, how I think I look at the world in contrast to David's social democracy. I would consider myself, as it were, a liberal realist. Liberal in the sense that in moral and value and political terms, I believe in the idea of freedom of the individual and freedom of association and the rule of law within the context of reasonably well-defined, we can discuss that further, states, and a realist in the sense, not as in international relations theory, someone who believes that only power matters, but certainly somebody who believes that power matters. And I think those two aspects of my thinking will probably become reasonably clear as this proceeds. To clarify where I start, and just in case there are any doubts about this, I'm going to start by this quote which I use in my book, which comes from two very well-known economists who did a very good survey of globalization and development, and they made a point which I think actually most economists would agree with, though there's lots of disagreement, as I'm sure will emerge, on the policy implications, which is that in the post-war period, the ability to exploit opportunities in international exchange, and particularly trade, and to engage more deeply with it, has been a necessary, though I would insist, I would happily agree, not a sufficient condition for rapid economic growth. So without being able to manage what we call now, and I generally agree the hideous word globalization, without being able to manage that, development really doesn't work. I've also added a quote because I wanted to say this. It comes from Mario Vargas Llosa, well-known Peruvian novelist and liberal, who rejected utterly the use of the word neoliberal to define this position. And he said, as you will see, a neo is someone who pretends to be something, who is at the same time inside and outside of something. It is an elusive hybrid, a straw man set out without ever identifying a specific value, idea, regime, or doctrine. To say neoliberal is the same as saying semi-liberal or pseudo-liberal. It is pure nonsense. Either one is in favor of liberty or against it, but one cannot be semi-in favor or pseudo-in favor of liberty, just as one cannot be semi-pregnant, semi-living, or semi-dead. In other words, I am not a neoliberal. And in return for not being called a neoliberal, I'm happy not to call anyone here a neo-Marxist. What I wish to cover in this talk is three big issues which I think divide us reasonably clearly in the end. And the first is, what do we mean by globalization? What's going on out there? And I think I'm taking very appropriately for this lecture a good Marxist position, which is essentially I start with the base, the productive base and technology. And the second thing I want to discuss much more briefly than I would like is some aspects of the record of the second age of globalization, what has worked well and what has not. And then I'm going to go over my, I have to admit, relatively modest and limited suggestions of how we can make it work better, because it follows from my liberal realism that David's ideas of completely restructuring the entire global order, to me, are a fantasy. And therefore, I want to make it possible for him to say, well, actually, they're completely realistic and sensible and not a fantasy, so I'm going to give him something to attack. Let me start by defining globalization David, I know, is very unhappy, he says, with this notion. He says globalization is economics and politics and society and culture. Indeed, it's absolutely everything. And I tend to think that something's absolutely everything is absolutely nothing. So I think we have to start with a relatively defined notion of what we talk about. And it seems to me, first of all, because I'm an economist, so I would think that anyway, wouldn't I? But I think also that it is perfectly obvious if you look at what we're talking about. We're talking about an economic process. Good Marxist position to start off with. I define it as the process of integration of economies through markets across frontiers. And it seems to me that if we look at the world today, what is going on when we talk about globalization is essentially three things at the same time. Two of which are essential to it, and one of which is contingent, but fantastically important in understanding what's going to happen, what is happening, and what's going to happen. And those are technological change, the ongoing process of the reduction in the cost of transport and communications, which has very specific characteristics in our time, quite different from those, for instance, not quite different from, but in certain ways distinct in their balance from the 19th century. Second, economic liberalization, the worldwide move to the market, and finally, probably the most important event of all, the return of Asia as a great power, or Asian countries as great powers, and increasingly as prosperous economies. And underlying all the, particularly the second of these, of course, as you all know, there was in the 1980s, and particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, a worldwide liberalization revolution, as essentially communism, extreme socialism, planning and import substitution, all the ideas of the early part of my career in development were abandoned, and globalization is what followed. Now let me talk first about the technology side of this, because if something very big is going on here, something is going to happen to the economic system, at least in the long run, and we have to adjust and adapt to it. I think the biggest driver, fairly obviously, in the recent past is the IT revolution. Transport and communication costs, as I will show, have not fallen very dramatically. The major driver in the last 25 years has been the communications revolution. Indeed, if I may just make a comment on transport and communications, there has actually been no fundamental breakthrough in transport technology for a century. The last really great breakthrough was civil aviation. You can add the rocket, obviously it's moderately important, and even that's 80 years old now. So basically in transport and communications we're just in marginal improvements, but IT is fundamental in its changes. And we don't know yet its full implications, but one thing is pretty clear. It is making possible, in the right conditions, the unbundling of production chains vertically across the world. And for the first time, and I think we can't stress the significance of this too much, it is making parts of services more tradable than manufacturers. And that is going to transform our economies very profoundly. This is a chart in logarithmic chart, and the slopes, of course, show the rate of decline of what's happened to the cost of telephony and satellites. And essentially what's happened over the last 70 years, and particularly in the last 20 years, is telephony has moved from an extreme luxury to being as cheap as dirt. We're now living in a world when communication is essentially free. And as a byproduct of that, we have a simply staggering explosion in the world's use of the most formidable communications technology ever invented, the internet. And this shows, again, in logarithmic on a logarithmic scale, the share of the populations of different parts of the world on the internet. And the world as a whole is now over 10%, and you will see that emerging Asia is now considerably above that. About 20% of emerging Asia is now on the net. In fact, there are more users of the internet in emerging Asia as a whole than there is in any other region of the world, even though the penetration is relatively low. I think there has been no major technology in world history which has achieved penetration at this level. This really is a transformation of the base, as in Marxist terminology. In terms of transport costs, as I show here, the declines are relatively modest in the last 20 years. They've been somewhat more significant for air transport than they have for sea freight, but we are living in a communications revolution-driven integration process. The second element, as I said, is liberalization. And as I pointed out, we have seen over the last 20 years an extraordinary worldwide move in the direction of the market and liberalization at the border. This shows simply the trends in average tariff rates. It's one simple indicator for the developed countries at the bottom, the developing countries in the blue line, and I think most astonishingly, China in the green line. And what you will see there is that the developing countries, on average, their tariffs fell from about 30% in the early 80s to about 10% in the late part of the last century. And you will see that China has moved from having essentially prohibitive barriers to trade in the early 90s to being about as liberal as the industrial countries in a period of 10 years. No major country in history that I am aware of has ever liberalized so completely and on such a large scale. In addition, there has been a pretty well comprehensive abolition of exchange controls in the industrial countries since the early 1980s, when more than half of them continued to have exchange controls. Now, as you can see, it's down actually to zero. There is no significant industrial country, according to the IMF, with exchange controls. And the astonishing thing is a similar process can be observed in the developing countries, and the developing countries today, in terms of the proportion with exchange controls, are very close to the developed countries in the early 80s. And this occurred despite the financial crises, which are very well known, that occurred during the 90s, 80s and 90s. The liberalization process continued, and now about 40% of all developing countries had no restrictions on exchange, no exchange controls. The third element in the picture that we now see before us, which is both a fundamental economic revolution, and here I would certainly agree with David and anyone in the international relations or international political economy fields, also a political transformation, is the rise of Asia, or the spread of rapid industrialization and rapid economic growth to a region which contains well over half of humanity, which it has contained, as far as we know, more than half of humanity for all of the last two millennia or more, and of course contained historically a number of the world's greatest civilizations. In terms of what's happening in relationship to the Industrial Revolution, we, I think, can say that you can see three great waves of economic development and power transformation over the last two centuries. It started with the rise of the UK in the early to mid-19th century. The late 19th and early 20th century saw the rise of the US, Japan, and Germany. I should add Russia to that group. And, of course, that led, and that's important for another subject which we probably won't get to today, or may not get to today, that led to a century of conflict between the US, Japan, Germany, and Russia, from which the United States finally emerged victorious in 1989. And then in the post-Second World War period, we have seen the return of Asia, first the resurgence of Japan after its defeat in the Second World War, and of course, more recently, China's rise, and followed again behind it, India. So we are seeing, I believe, the era which is the end of the European dominance and the dominance of Europe and its immediate colonial offshoots, of which the US is the most important, of course, over the world. And just to indicate what that means, I've taken this chart, I've used it before, from Angus Maddison, which shows the shares of Asia in world GDP at purchasing power parity since the early 19th century. And you can see that back in the early 19th century, according to calculations, Asia generated about 60% of world GDP. Of course, most of it wasn't traded then. This collapsed in the long 150-odd years of failure to well under 20% in 1950. Then we started seeing the recovery led by Japan, which was the yellow bloc, rising to 8% share by the early to mid-1970s, and since then, the resurgence has continued with the rise of China above all, and more recently of India. The Asian share is still below its share of world population, about 38%, but it is rising extremely rapidly. And driving that rise is unquestionably an astonishing level of integration into the world economy. I've just showed the trade ratios to GDP and the ratio of FDI, the inward stock of FDI to GDP for China, South Korea, compared with a number of major developed countries in 2004 and 2003, respectively. The recent adjustments of China's GDP would lower those shares somewhat, but it wouldn't change the fundamental picture, which is that China today is certainly the most open large economy in world history at market prices, comparing with much smaller economies like South Korea. This is an astonishing level of integration into the global system. So that's what's going on. And I thought it was very important to anchor this debate in a discussion of the economic drivers, the policy drivers, and the country drivers of the integration process that we are seeing today. So what has this meant for us in terms of the record? What has actually happened to some of the things we care about? Well, first of all, what's happened to the integration process, and then some of the things that, where are we on development, inequality, and poverty? This is the subject I just want to discuss briefly in a few minutes. First of all, over the last 20 years, as you can see, if you use global GDP as the denominator and you take almost any international activity, the FDI inward stock, the gross product of foreign affiliates, the exports by foreign affiliates, exports of goods and services, and sales of foreign affiliates, they've all risen faster than global GDP. Basically, the world economy is integrating in the sense that internationally oriented activities are rising faster than the world activity as a whole. And one of the most striking aspects of that, in fact, is the FDI role. We have had seen a total transformation in attitudes to and willingness to accept FDI in the last 20 years or so. But if you look at ratios of trade in goods to goods GDP, as you can see for a whole range of countries, I put a lot of them here, between 1990 and 2002, you see a very big rise in the tradability of goods GDP, and that I would suggest is all linked to the increased vertical disintegration of production, the ability to organize production, locate it in countries for which it's particularly well suited, and trade it. So the whole of goods GDP has become more tradable basically everywhere, and you can see it's happened in the very large economies and also in the small economies, including our own. Now let me just say a little bit about this very vexed issue on which there are 573 different measures, and I recognize all the problems of some of the things that have happened to global income inequality among people, among households, this is essentially, over the last 20 years in a historical context. The first point is we live at the end of a very long-term process or in which global inequality among households has risen. It started in the early 19th century and continued, as far as we can see, consistently until about 1970 to 1980. And the reason for that, I will come to in a moment, is essentially the divergence in average incomes per head among countries because of the divergence in average growth rates among countries. Compounding makes a huge difference over long periods, and it has made a sensational difference. And the result is global income is astonishingly unequally distributed, as everybody knows. In the last 20 years, this is a paper that goes up to 95, there seems to be some modest reversal, bringing us back roughly to where we were in 1950. If we decompose this into its components, as I said, the overwhelming source of global inequality is the inequality among countries, the divergence in average incomes among countries, which started in the early 19th century with the Industrial Revolution, and that's shown in the purple line, and you can see that reached a peak between 1970 and 1980 and began to reverse, while the inequality on average within countries fell a bit in the early part of the 20th century and then rose rather a small amount in the second half of the 20th century. So the dominant force driving the green line, which is essentially the same thing as I showed you before, is the divergence in average incomes among countries, from which it follows that globalization matters to the extent that it facilitates relatively rapid growth on average in poorer countries. This chart essentially uses the same methodology, but a broader data set because for the more recent periods we have better data sets, which indicates the same overall pattern just for the last 20 years or so, that there has been some modest decline in the in this measure, mean logarithmic deviation inequality. Interestingly, and crucially for my argument for what I think is just going on, the big reversal, as you see, occurred between the late 1980s and the early 1990s, and then it went on again. And the reason for that reversal was simply the Tiananmen Square incident, as they call it in China, euphemistically, in 89, and the Indian crisis in 91, because China and India, which contain 40% of the world's population, are driving these figures in large measure. If you look at extreme poverty in the same very long period, that the numbers in extreme poverty, the World Bank's data uses a dollar a day as the reference point, seems to have reached a peak of about 1.4 billion in between 1950 and 1980, and there seems to have been a modest decline. The share of the world population in extreme poverty, basically on the subsistence margin, on these data has fallen, obviously these heroic analyses, but essentially have fallen from about 80% to about 20% over the last 200 years. The divergence between these two, of course, is an indication of the most obvious fact about the world over the last 200 years, which is that the population has increased roughly six times. So the share of people in extreme poverty can fall, the most extreme forms of poverty, even though the numbers are rising because of population growth. And I think it is important to understand the implications of population growth for the challenge of lowering poverty and the challenge of lowering inequality. And this is shown, I think, rather clearly from these UN figures for the world population. They divide the world up into the current least developed countries, a well-known list of, I think, somewhat over 40 least developed countries, the rest of the developing countries, and then the industrial countries. And over the last 50 years, the industrial country population has basically risen very little. The developing country population has increased about 2.5 times, and the population of the least developed countries has tripled, and is expected to almost to triple again over the next 50 years. And that's part of the background for this disappointing story. In terms of absolute numbers living on less than a dollar a day, basically what has happened is exactly consistent with what one would have expected from the rise of Asia and its astonishing success of Asian countries, and above all China, in exploiting global opportunities. And you can see here the dramatic decline in mass, in the proportion of the pop, in the absolute numbers of people in East Asia, and particularly in China, in extreme poverty, a much smaller decline in South Asia, and a movement in the exact opposite direction in sub-Saharan Africa, exactly what you'd expect from the data we know on growth. And in terms of the proportions of the population, we've had, again, this staggering decline in the proportion in extreme poverty in China, from 61% to 17% over 20 years. I think that's probably the biggest reduction in absolute terms, and probably in proportionate terms, of people in extreme poverty in any country ever. And since China has 1.3 billion people, it obviously has a very profound effect on the overall numbers, which you can see in the bottom row. Again, South Asia has fallen over this period from 52% to 31%, and the reason that goes with those relatively poor figures for the numbers is simply because the South Asian population has been growing considerably faster than the Asian, East Asian one, and sub-Saharan Africa, we know the population has been exploding. So that's basically seems to me the broad history. We have a very powerful process of integration going on, technology driven and so forth. Now let me just bring together that part before I go to the final section, which I'll get through, I think, relatively quickly. What seems to me to have gone on is, and I'm really trying to provide this as sort of as objective as I can, is that one enormous opportunity has emerged in the globalization process, the integration process. And that has essentially been the opportunity to engage in the export of manufactures, and now increasingly, but it's a very recent opportunity, a very recent one, so its full implications we don't know, labour-intensive services as well. About 70% of the exports of developing countries are now manufactures. It's an astonishing change. It's a very long way from where they were 40 or 50 years ago, and the growth of exports of manufactures from developing countries has been enormously rapid. It follows from this that it is the countries that have been in a good position to exploit those opportunities that have done best out of the globalization opportunity. And it has turned out that incomparably the most successful in exploiting the opportunities of labor-intensive manufactures have been the, at least initially, labor surplus economies of Asia, particularly East Asia. The opportunities in traditional tropical commodities have been dismal. I discuss that at great length in my book, and there's not much we're going to be able to do about that because of fundamental demand characteristics. And the opportunities for countries with large and valuable resources, particularly like oil, have largely been wasted in corruption and other similar problems. So in the retrospect, we can say that the rise of Asia is very closely related with globalization, because the Asian countries have been uniquely successful in exploiting the greatest of all the opportunities afforded by contemporary globalization. Now let me turn to what I think a sort of modest agenda is for trying to make all this work more successfully. And I have to admit that I can easily reproduce the solutions for the entire planet tomorrow, but nothing is easier, but I don't believe that they are credible or plausible. So I think one has to start more or less where we are and see how we can improve things. So the first point I would stress is a global governance system which amounts to something fairly close to a global government is unavailable for the foreseeable future. We do live in a world of states, and those states remain jealous and powerful. Many people in Europe see the European Union as the model for the future. When I look at the United States and China, which will certainly be the great powers of the next half century, I don't think the model of Europe is relevant to either. Relations among states will continue to be based on relative power. David will argue, I'm sure, because he's argued before, that I ignore the realities of power. I would answer to him that I take power seriously. It cannot be wished away in some social democratic fantasy. Now, we have to have some debate, after all. Governance will change as power changes, and I have a long discussion in other presentations, which I won't be able to go through now, on why that could actually implode the whole world system, not for necessarily for the better, as we saw in the early half of the 20th century. I agree that states should identify the need to cooperate. There are very important things we need to do together, but I believe that all the evidence suggests we only do that well if we construct very specific, well-targeted regimes for very specific and very well-targeted purposes. The WHO is a perfect example of that, and so I believe is the WTO. And I would like to stress that I do not believe globalization is a panacea for all ills. It is an opportunity that countries have to find some way to exploit, and I recognize that lots of countries find it very difficult to do so. Let's go through, if I may, my main conclusions in my book. The first one was simply the obvious one, is we've tried all the alternatives to the market economy, and broadly defined, this does not exclude people trying to promote new industries and so forth. On the whole, it fails, but sometimes it succeeds. But broadly defined, the market economy won. Second, as I said already, and I just underline it, that we have to live with the reality of states. I argue at great length in my book that states, far from being irrelevant, are more important than ever, nor are is their legitimacy and effectiveness fundamentally eroded by globalization. I think that's all nonsense. Third, to underline this point, it's the interests of states and their citizens to participate in international treaty-based regimes and institutions that deliver global public goods, and I've discussed a number of them here. Unfortunately, the US, that was responsible creating for most of those institutions, has now seems to have completely forgotten why it did so. This is a rather big problem. Fourth, regimes need to be specific, focused, and enforceable. Fifth, I'm not going to go in detail to what I think about the WTO, except that I think negotiations on trade liberalisation among 145 countries are impossible and unworkable and have to be fundamentally changed. And I think the same applies to anything you want to do about investment or global competition. We can't have global regimes, but we could possibly have some more limited regimes. I accept fully, not fully, but I accept largely the critique of the working of global financial markets, which is in fact the subject of my current book, what I'm writing about. And while I think countries should plan to integrate, they should be very careful in doing so. And that is particularly true in the evident absence of any sort of global lender of last resort. I don't believe greater aid will guarantee development, but the aid sums are so small and so many countries are in such difficulties that trying a greater and bigger aid program is perfectly justified, and I support the Sachs proposals as I did last year. And finally, and this is a point on which some people in the audience might be surprised at my position, I actually have become increasingly, fitting perhaps with a sovereigntist. That is to say, I am increasingly happy with the idea that countries should be allowed to screw up any way they please, within reason. Within reason, I do believe that the attempts of the World Bank and IMF to run countries from outside, and I was learnt that in my own life, was a serious error. But we can't say that without also accepting the fact that we live in a world in which at least 500 million people and possibly a billion live in states which are effectively completely dysfunctional. And if we can't deal with that problem, we are not even going to begin to be able to tackle the development challenges we all face. Thank you.
We've had the bull. And now we're over to the matador.
The metaphor is all wrong, of course. There are two bulls in the arena, and I'll be happy to see Martin out in Lincoln Inn Field later when we can graze together and discuss the results of this exchange. But I definitely feel in the presence of Martin very much a bull. Secondly, let's just get it out of the way straight away. I am an idealist. I'm delighted to be an idealist. I'm in favor of more utopianism, not less. At least I was an idealist till David Cameron became an idealist. And now I have to sort of wonder what's at stake here. But before I go on, let me just make a couple of acknowledgements. There are many people in this audience whose work I think has contributed enormously to the debate about globalization, the debate that I've written in and that Martin has written in so superbly. And I'd like to just mention two people here, Robert Wade and Anthony McGrew, because Robert's work has influenced me greatly, as you'll see in some of the remarks that follow. And Anthony McGrew has worked with me on globalization for over 10 years. And I wouldn't be making, for better or worse, some of the arguments I'm going to be making this evening if it wasn't for having learnt from both of them and many more people in this room. So let me start by saying how much I admire a great deal of Martin Wolf's work, both as a scholar and as a journalist. I think Why Globalization Works, his last major book, is a lucid and fine defense of the liberal approach to the global economy. His writings are always my first port of call in the FT, and tonight's lecture is another example, if one were needed, of his clear and serious voice in the debate about globalization. And there's much common ground. We share enlightenment ideals, something that Martin hasn't spoken of this evening, but we do, and a commitment to a politics and policy approach that encourages and sustains the enormous enhancement of productivity and wealth that the global market and contemporary technology make possible. We would agree, moreover, that economic isolationism or cutting off countries from the world economy is not a way to ensure an economy prospers in the long run. I'm trying to clear myself a bit of space here for my rough notes. But rather than dwelling on common ground, I want to take a somewhat different tack in my 20-25 minutes this evening. In brief, what I want to argue is that the current liberal approach to and form of globalization has inherent weaknesses, and that we need to grasp these if we are to contribute to a discussion of the sustainability of the global order itself. And I want to suggest that Martin's own approach to these matters and his account of economic globalization inadequately engages with the core problems of liberal globalization in its current liberal form. And I want to stress four difficulties. First, that global market integration is by no means the indispensable condition for development. Second, that there are grounds for skepticism that the liberal economic policies deliver on promised goods. Third, that a market-first approach to key trans-border issues is an adequate approach to those issues. And four, that liberal market philosophy is the wrong philosophy for the age in which we live. I want to suggest instead a cosmopolitan social democratic philosophy to guide a world of overlapping fortunes among countries. Cosmopolitan because certain universal standards, human rights, environmental protection are central. Social democratic because markets and social justice need to check each other. So let me start by quoting Martin from his last book, when he wrote his key thesis is that a successful move to the market, including increasing integration in the world economy, explains the success stories of the past two decades. Prospering developing countries, notably the Asian, have all followed this path. But this account, I want to suggest, needs questioning in a number of respects. In the first instance, the experience of China and India, along before with Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, shows that countries do not simply have to adopt liberal trade or capital policies in order to benefit from enhanced trade and to grow faster. All these countries have grown relatively fast behind some kinds of protective barriers and growth which fueled rapid trade expansion. Now, it's true that as these countries have become richer, they have tended to liberalize their trade policies. China's deep tariff cuts are a particular feature of the past decade, as Martin's figure in this respect shows. But as Danny Roderick has shown, and he was here before Christmas, the only thing that can be said with certainty is that countries tend to become more open as they become richer. It's not simply a matter of cause and effect, and the difference matters. Furthermore, recent research has found that one of the key factors limiting the capacity of some of the poorest countries to develop is the rapid liberalization of capital. What hurts developing countries faced with broad liberalization agendas is not necessarily the free pursuit of free trade, but the free movement of capital. Capital account liberalization in Latin America and Eastern Europe, as well as in Asia, has brought instability, volatility, and on more than one occasion, full-blown financial crisis. Countries that have rapidly opened their capital accounts have performed significantly less well in terms of economic growth than countries that have maintained tighter control on capital movements but cut tariffs. Now, even as, of course, Martin would know, the IMF admits that how misguided was its earlier blanket support for liberalizing financial markets in developing countries willy-nilly. Now, while economic protectionism should be rejected as a general economic strategy, there's much evidence to suggest that working on a country's internal economic integration, the development of its human capital, robust national market institutions, needs to be stimulated by economic and industrial policy. The development of state regulatory capacity, a sound public domain, the ability to focus investment on job-creating sectors, and the protection of infant industries is more important than integration into world markets per se. In fact, all of these elements that I've listed seem to be critical for effective global integration. And this finding should not come as a surprise, since nearly all of today's developed countries initiated their growth behind tariff barriers and lowered these only once their economies were relatively robust. Commenting in the FT on Martin Wolf's recent writings on the urgency of further trade liberalization through the Doha Round, Robert Wade, sitting over there, one of Martin's fiercest critics, but otherwise a very nice guy, put the point and summarizes the issues thus, and I want to quote his recent letter in the FT, quote, "A balanced reading of the empirical evidence does not strongly support Mr. Wolf's presumption in favor of further trade liberalization by all countries. the most successful developing countries of the past two decades, including China, India, and Vietnam, have had high tariff and non-tariff barriers and a raft of other policies not consistent with the WTO agreements. On the one hand, many countries that subscribe to trade liberalization, many countries that subscribe to trade liberalization and other policies of the Washington Consensus and enforce WTO agreements have been among the least successful compared both to East Asia on the one side and their earlier performance under less liberal policies on the other. And the quote goes on just for one moment. Mr. Wolf's analytical mistake is to take a static view, as in, quote, a bias towards production for domestic markets guarantees a failure to grow up, end quote. East Asian experience shows this to be nonsense, says Robert. East Asian trade regimes have been strategic rather than across the board, integrated into larger industrial policies of transformation. Nonsense, you think, might be harsh, but I'm going to come on to comments that Martin has made a little bit later, which seem to me, to throw down the gauntlet. In Why Globalization Works, Martin accepts that there's much more involved in successful development than trade liberalization, and the financial liberalization carries risks, and he's made those points this evening. But he doesn't seem to me to allow that these concessions have implications for the very basis of the liberal market approach. That's to say, its explanatory power, what's explaining what, and its prescriptive values, what matters most. Now, the benign view of globalization interprets it as stimulating growth and development around the world. Openness to trade and investment, so the story goes, boosts growth, and growth raises the income of the poor and thereby reduces poverty. Good. As Martin wrote in his last book and has indeed again suggested this evening, and I want to read this quote carefully, what the successful countries all share is a move towards a market economy. They choose, however, haltingly, the path of economic liberalization and international integration. This is the heart of the matter. All else is commentary. That's a very strong statement. So it does throw down the gauntlet, as it were, to the charge of no. Now, there are several grounds for skepticism about this view of the liberal market and the results of liberalization, and I want to be skeptical for a few moments. As Dunny Roderick forcefully argued here at the LSE before Christmas, and in accord with Robert's work, countries that have benefited most from globalization are those that have not played by the rules of the standard liberal market approach. Again, China, India, Vietnam, and even Uganda. In addition, there have been those, for example, in Latin America and the Caribbean that have done worse, judged by the standards of East Asia and their own past standards, and they played by those rules. In other words, the link between growth, economic openness, and liberalization is perhaps weaker than the standard liberal argument suggests. The widespread shift among developing countries to greater openness, in fact, coincides with a slowdown in the rate of world economic growth in the post-war period, from 2.7% in 1960 to 78 to 1.5% from 79 to 2000. Now, the link between growth and poverty reduction is also not as marked as the liberal argument would predict. Accounts of this type generally assume a catch-up or convergence story, whereby poorer countries, opening their markets and liberalizing, are expected to grow faster and richer so that income differentials narrow over time. However, the evidence to support this is controversial. In the first instance, outside the phenomenal development of China, and to some extent India, the reported number of people below the World Bank poverty line of $1 a day, as Martin said, has actually risen in the past two decades from 1981. I say outside the phenomenal development of China and to some extent India. In addition, there's a near perfect correlation between a group's relative standing at the beginning of the 90s and its real cumulative income gains in the years that followed. The evidence shows that gains at the bottom of the global income hierarchy were minimal or even negative, as the first, that's to say bottom percentile, lost 7.3%, and the second gained only 1%. Moreover, the World Bank measure of absolute poverty based on $1 a day is to a large extent arbitrary. If you take the figure of $2 a day, you can actually show the reverse trends to the ones that Martin has focused on. But going below that and beneath that as well, we have to ask, what does that standard signify. We do not know to what extent it covers adequacy for food, clothing, shelter, and other vital goods. And a recent study from Latin America that looks at poverty more broadly, looking at a poverty line based on colorific and demographic characteristics, shows poverty to be seriously underestimated by these conventional World Bank positions. Now, examining and evaluating trends in income inequality between countries, it is clear that much depends again on how China's economic success and its subsequent reduction in poverty is treated, as indeed Martin's argument to some extent this evening has gone along with. If China is excluded from consideration, inequality between countries can be shown to have increased since 1980. 1980 is an important date because that's often the date, some take 1970, others 1980, the date at which it was thought that income inequality between countries had reached its peak. But if China is excluded, inequality between countries can be shown to have increased since 1980. Of course, there's much to be said for including China in the account. But then, it has to be borne in mind that China's success has depended significantly on a host of factors, not all of which fit neatly into the liberal argument. Moreover, looking at income distribution across the world's individuals or households highlights how the largest gains over the 1990s accrued to those already well off and to the middle classes or the better off in China. China makes the difference, and what sense we are to make of it depends again on how this success is explained. What does it show in explanatory terms, prescriptive terms? The argument inequality among individuals has been falling over the past two decades, often heard, depends largely on the performance of this one particular very strong case, though not exclusively. And China is different because China is not just a model liberalizer. It's staggered and regulated its entry into the global market. It's cut tariffs, as I've said, but done so after economic takeoff has been secured, and heavily in the last 10 to 12 years. It's indeed been progressively liberalizing its trade policy, but it's highly regulated capital movements and insists on non-convertibility of its currency. And FDI is locked into strong political partnerships agreement, significantly steered by political agendas. I could go on. Now, none of this is to argue that trade and international capital flows do not provide important potential gains to many countries. The questions rather are under what conditions trade and capital flows and what kind of trade and capital flows most benefit countries and maximize that benefit. Thinking of globalization as either an inexorably positive force or the opposite is likely to miss the core conditions for successful development and political change, which I think are closer to Martin's point 10 in his list than his points 1 and 2. The choice is not, I think, between globalization in its liberal free market form or no globalization. Rather, what's at issue is the proper form globalization should take. What is needed is proposals for thinking about the governance of national and international markets and for pressing and considering the range of global challenges we face. And I want to turn now to the range of global challenges we face, which seem to me to be severe indeed. While there are many ways of conceiving and categorizing the global challenges we must all tackle, Jean-François Richard from the World Bank usefully thinks of them as forming three core sets of problems: those concerned with sharing our planet, like global warming, biodiversity, our humanity, poverty, global infectious diseases, and our rule books, intellectual property rights, trade, finance, tax rules, and so on. Martin seems to think that global challenges such as these can be addressed by the current interstate order, although he may not be so optimistic, albeit one that needs some change, his points 3, 4, and 5, I think. But how pressing global problems might be resolved is far from clear, for the problem-solving capacity of the current international system is not effective, accountable, or fast enough. Take climate change. According to Sir David King, the government's chief scientist, it may be too late. According to Sir Martin Rees, the former chief astronomer, it seems highly unlikely that we will get through the next century without some major catastrophe. Take nuclear proliferation. Take the broad failure to meet the millennium goals. each one of these is serious enough, but taken together, they are very challenging. Why? There are three main difficulties. To begin with, there's no clear division of labor among the myriad of international institutions. Functions often overlap, mandates conflict, aims and objectives too often get blurred. There are a number of competing organizations, all of which have some stake in shaping many aspects of public policy. This is true, for example, in the area of AIDS, HIV, where the WHO, the Global Fund, UNAIDS, and the G1 have different and often competing priorities. Mike Moore used to say when he was head of the WTO, "I didn't know a damn what was going on in these other agencies, and so it was hard to make sense of what our next move should be." A second set of difficulties relates to an accountability deficit in the international agencies, those very agencies setting the core agendas. Multilateral bodies need to be fully representative of the states involved in them, and they rarely are. Developing countries are seriously underrepresented in a sleuth of international organizations. And the third problem I want to briefly mention results from the issues which span the domestic and the foreign. A growing number of issues can be called, to use an ugly word, intermestic. That is, issues which cross the international and domestic, intermestic, Jim Rosenau's term. These are often insufficiently understood, comprehended, or acted upon. And there's often a lack of ownership about such problems at the global level. Global warming, biodiversity, whose problem is it exactly? Some leaders worry about it, some leaders don't, but meanwhile it progresses and deepens. The institutional fragmentation and competition leads not just to the problems of overlapping jurisdictions among agencies, but also to the problem of issues falling between them. Bill Gates said recently in London, "The failure to address the issue of malaria, where we know what we need to do and where the costs are not great, is simply a disgrace." And the time has come, to say the least, to examine these matters again. Now, I don't think we can be too optimistic about dealing with some of the most pressing issues that I've mentioned. But if it's idealism to raise these questions and to begin to think through an alternative political theory to these big issues and our institutional lacunae, then I think we should all be idealists. Finally, to address the problems of institutional fragmentation, competition, and jurisdictional overlaps requires a wider framework of institutions and policy approaches than I think can be found in Martin's framework of markets plus liberal states. And clues to an alternative can be found in that old rival, social democracy. Why is it important? It mean not, I don't need to stand here and defend its record in all respects, but it speaks to the silence in the liberal approach, and the silence is social justice. Traditionally, social democrats have sought to deploy the democratic institutions of individual countries on behalf of a particular project. They've accepted that markets are central to economic well-being, but have recognized that in the absence of appropriate regulation, they suffer serious flaws. These include the generation of unwanted risks for their citizens and an unequal distribution on who bears those risks. Social democracy at the level of the nation state means supporting free markets while insisting on a framework of shared values and common institutional practices. At the global level, it means pursuing an economic agenda which calibrates the freeing of markets with poverty reduction programs and the protection of the vulnerable. But this agenda needs to be pursued while ensuring, on the one hand, that different countries have the freedom they need to experiment with their own investment strategies and resources, as my first set of remarks indicated, and on the other, that domestic policy choices uphold certain basic universal standards, such as human rights and environmental protection. So the question is, the big question is, the very big question, it seems to me, is how can self-determination, markets, and core universal standards coexist? How can self-determination, markets, and core universal standards coexist? You might not like my answer, but I think the question is important. To begin with, to give you my answer briefly, although set out at greater length in Global Covenant and in debates that Martin and I have had in debating globalization and elsewhere, to begin with, it seems to me, bridges have to be built between international economic law and human rights law, between commercial law and environmental law, between state sovereignty and transnational law. It's as if now all these things refer to separate domains and do not speak to each other. This point was first made, at least I first grasped this point when I read something of our own LSE's own Christine Chinkin's work, and it was almost a throwaway line in her writing, but it's been a very important thought for me. What is required is not only the firm enactment of existing human rights and environmental agreements and the clear linking of these with the ethical codes of particular industries, but also, I believe, the introduction of new terms of reference into the ground rules or basic laws of the free market and trade system. Precedents exist in the social chapter of the Maastricht Agreement or in the attempt to attach labor and environmental conditions to the NAFTA regime. At stake, ultimately, is three interrelated transformations. This is my list, as it were. The first would involve engaging companies in the promotion of core universal principles, as the UN's Global Compact does at present. To the extent that this would lead to the entrenchment of human rights and environmental standards and corporate practices, that would be a significant step forward. But if it's to be something other than voluntary, vulnerable to being ignored, then it needs to be elaborated in due course into a set of more codified and mandatory rules. As Kofi Annan's chief advisor on these very issues said, we have no idea whether the voluntary nature of the Global Compact has at this stage any bite at all. So the second set of transformations would involve the entrenchment of revised rules and codes on health, child labor, trade union activity, environmental protection, stakeholder consultation, and so on, in the Articles of Association of Economic Organizations and Trading Agencies. The key groups and associations of the economic domain would have to adopt, in their very modus operandi, a structure of rules and procedures and practices compatible with universal social requirements, if these requirements are to prevail. Now, of course, it can be countered that poorly designed regulatory structures harm employment levels. Bang, ringing already is an objection. But countries with the strongest social democratic traditions, above all the Scandinavian, show that it is possible to be both business-friendly and welfare-oriented. Now, there are many possible objections to the scheme I have set out, but I think most of these are misplaced. The framework of human rights and environmental values is, I believe, sound because it's preoccupied with the equal liberty and equal development possibilities of all human beings. But it has to be conceded that without a third set of changes, the advocacy of such standards descends into moral high-mindedness because it fails to pursue socioeconomic changes that are a necessary part of such a commitment. So at a minimum, this means that development policies must be, as I've already indicated, linked to promoting the development space necessary for national trade and industrial incentives, including infant industry protection, to building robust public sectors, nurturing political and legal reform, to develop transparent, accountable political institutions, to ensure long-term investment in healthcare, human capital, and physical infrastructure, to challenge the asymmetries of access to the global market, which are often hypocritical and absurd and indefensible, and to ensure the sequencing of global market integration into a framework of fair rules and for trade and finance. In addition, this means eliminating odious debt, unsustainable debt, and creating new finance facilities for development purposes. And it means, in addition, to link such measures, I believe that such measures rather must be combined with a Tobin tax on the turnover of financial markets, or consumption tax on fossil fuels, or a shift in the priorities of military expenditure, now running at $900 billion per annum globally, towards the alleviation of severe need, because direct aid only amounts to some $50 billion per annum globally. If shifts of these kinds, however small, were to occur, then the development context of Western and northern nation states could begin to be accommodated more adequately to those nations struggling for survival and minimum welfare. UN budget is $1.2 billion plus peacekeeping. But if you take any serious accounts in the US or Europe of amounts spent on chocolate and bubblegum, alcohol, cars, pet food and so on, these budgets vastly dwarf the advance available for direct poverty alleviation and dealing with severe urgent diseases. The US, of course, went to war after 9/11. 9/11 was a serious matter, a crime against the United States and a crime against humanity. I believe, although it's not the topic of this conversation, but it was a mistaken and misjudged war. But every day, 10 times as many people die of poverty and malnutrition and poverty-related diseases. And yet, there is no war, no cry, no demand for more decisive change. I believe the resources are there. This is about politics. In conclusion, the question before us is not why globalization works, but rather how can it be made to work better to bridge the gap between liberty, important, social justice, important, economic rights, important, human rights, important, and the accelerating affluence of some with the continuing poverty of the many. A political philosophy relevant to our global age, I believe, must take this as its starting point and build an ethically sound and politically robust conception of political communities and the relations among them. I call this a cosmopolitan social democratic approach, and I believe steps in this direction are feasible and practical. It's never all a matter of everything or nothing. Liberal economic philosophy, I think, doesn't equip us adequately for this journey. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. I was going to give Martin maybe a 2 or 3 minutes for a quick reply. If David then wants to pick up on anything, but then we want to move as quickly as possible to Q&A. Do you want to do it from here, Martin, or do you want to stand up? What do you want to do? I'll do it from here, yeah.
I'll do it from here.
Just quickly.
Unfortunately, I think at this stage I need another half hour.
You're 2 minutes.
I think David has... I was fairly forewarned, since he'd written much the same comments in his very thoughtful review of my book. Let me just cover two issues, which is, as it were, the interpretation of history and the social democratic alternative, and what seem to me the deep dilemmas, which he's not addressing in trying to make that work in our present world. The interpretation of history, the problem, of course, here is we have far too many countries, far too many policies, and far too many experiences to draw any conclusive results. I can, of course, now cite a long list of literature assessing the relationships between trade and growth, econometrically on large pooled samples, some of it very, very clever, all of which comes to the conclusion that openness is correlated with growth. But let me also agree, because I stated this in my book, it's not a subject of disagreement, that there are huge problems in the liberalization of capital markets other than FDI, and I have never, ever written anything to suggest otherwise. But on the trade, I think the story is different. The big problem in our way, I think, is interpreting the success stories. What made these successes? And since the world is a complicated place, in practice, no regimes are ever pure and simple, except, of course, for the two most successful developing countries of all, which are clearly exceptional. I'm happy to accept that, Hong Kong and Singapore. Now, the problem goes something like this. If you look at the economic policies of the developing countries for most of the last 40 years, until relatively recently, the last 10 years or so, be they African countries or Latin American countries or Asian countries, what they all had in common, I don't think there are very few exceptions, clearly, is they had infant industry policies and they followed a policy of high protection. And of that very large sample of countries, a few, relatively small number of countries initially, and subsequently, I think a slightly, somewhat larger number of countries, some of them incredibly big, did relatively well. Now, I would argue and I think it's perfectly consistent with the evidence, that those countries that did well were countries that either from the very beginning of their industrial policies focused very, very heavy intention on the need for and the need for provision of incentives for effective international integration, or they were countries that moved steadily and progressively and not necessarily before their greater success, at the time of their greater success, towards the market in international integration. Let me take the example of one country which I happen to know better than any other, which is India. India's worst growth performance, it's of course the second largest country in the world, was under very high protective barriers. It started to grow faster as it started to liberalize the internal market, which is a very important part of the market for a country that big. And it's the most successful international industry by far, and its most successful dynamic industry by far, as the Indians like to joke. Software and everything that's gone with it has developed so rapidly because, as they comment, it's the only industry that has not suffered from having an Indian government ministry. So I would suggest, and I could go on for this forever, that the history is incredibly more nuanced and difficult than people suggest. The second, in terms of what made growth work, but I am happy to agree that merely liberalizing trade is not sufficient. It's merely a part of the growth process. Now, the second question, which is the really deep question, is what the nature of the international order and how the international order would work. Social democracy, in my view, is a philosophy anchored in, historically and practically, in states with a strong sense of mutual commitment to one another among the citizens of those states. It is, in fact, a philosophy basically of Western Europe and particularly of Northern Western Europe, where it has, of course, been stunningly successful. Now, the difficulty with it is that because people see themselves in national terms and they look at redistribution overwhelmingly in national terms, they clearly do not, in fact, have this highly developed sense, the extraordinarily highly developed sense of cosmopolitan social welfare that David wants. And that is shown not merely at the global level, it's striking, but even within the European Union, the most advanced structure put together internationally by social democrats, whose redistributive elements are absolutely insignificant. Now, in the absence of a commitment to redistribution on a really enormous scale, and it would have to be enormous given the scale of the poverty he's talked about, the states of most of the world have to look after themselves, and that is in fact what they do. And their view is that all these high-minded and very noble principles that David wants to foist upon them in all these areas are simply principles they cannot at their present level of development afford. In fact, they are anti-development and anti-growth. The problem of constructing a global order in so radically unequal a world, clearly it is a radically unequal world, constructed on the basis of states, is stupendous. And in its absence, I suggest, quite a few of the things that David wants to do are going to create more harm than good.
Thank you very much, David. I'll give you a couple of minutes to reply.
Yeah.
Fine.
I mean, we agree that history is more difficult, and that the methodological basis for calculating poverty reduction, the range of studies, and so on, can show a varying things. Your data, which shows steep declining poverty in one section, is clearly in contradiction, for example, to Branko Milanovic's work. And so to really move beyond a general discussion of these things, we would have to dig deeper into some methodological questions, which we can't do now. But just accepting that history is more difficult, I want to say that's why I think all else is not commentary. It's the argument, the overwhelming argument in Why Globalization Works and some other of your work, that precisely does suggest that all else is commentary, which seems to me
to obscure precisely the complexity of the historical diversity, the range of cases, the importance of national variation, and so on. Secondly, I mean, some of the most successful, of course, countries that have grown most rapidly in the post-war period, as you say, some of them in East Asia, did, of course, have infant industry protection. I mean, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, all pursued infant industry protection in electronics, automobiles, and so on, with preferential credit and protection from international competition. And they then went out to seek global markets, of course, for those goods and services. I mean, it was, of course, a two-pronged strategy, but it wasn't just liberalization. It was creating the economic base that made integration and the possibility of integration a good risk. Thirdly, I would just say about the social democratic agenda that I set out, it is about balancing liberty and social justice. I do find in your work a great absence at the feast, as it were, and the absent guest at the feast is this concern that I think should be uppermost, a concern with social justice, the fulfillment of human rights, the alleviation of severe need which people have not consented to and do not voluntarily accept. Of course, in its boldest form, it is a bold, big agenda. But so was the creation of the modern state. So was locking in Germany into the EU after the Second World War. So was the belief in the 80s that the communism might fall peacefully in a velvet revolution. No one thought these things were possible. Politics was automatically almost defined these options out. And yet these things happened. And they happened because people had certain ideals. Those ideals do not require an all or nothing agenda. The modern state was built in 300 years. It wasn't built when Hobbes and Locke wrote their great treaties. Likewise, the advocacy of the cosmopolitan social approach to these issues is about defining a direction of change. And in the meantime, there are things we can do. And in the meantime, books like Global Covenant and the books My Attempts to Defend It with you and others in debating globalization are about setting out a more concrete short-term agenda on issues of poverty reduction, trade, and so on. I can't elaborate more on all of this tonight. I've tried to lay out the agenda already once, and if anyone wants to see more, read the books. But I will say to some of my most wonderful students here, as I always say, this exchange of views itself guarantees that you have to go away and think these issues through for yourselves, and that's how it should be.
Thank you very much, David. I think we've got two definite positions. I need some hands to go up because we've got about 15 minutes, and I've seen the letter writer to the Times here, Robert Wade. At least you read a decent newspaper, Robert. Robert, I said that for Martin, but I do think so too. Martin, Robert.
I have a question to... Is this working? I have a question to Martin Wolfe.
Shout, Rob.
And it's about your book. Both tonight and in the book, you have shown that in the past 25 years or so, the world has moved very sharply in the direction of liberalism in terms of economic policy. There has been a very dramatic move towards economic integration. And nevertheless, you say that the potential for further economic integration has scarcely been tapped. So you look forward to an enormous continuing movement in the direction of liberalization. On the other hand, your book is a passionate wake-up call. You say that there are forces gathering, immensely powerful forces, gathering to stop this process of integration. In fact, you refer to them as, quote, the enemies gathering both outside and inside the gates. And as if that rhetoric were not emotional enough, in another column, you have referred to a set of people who you don't actually identify very clearly as preaching the big lie. Now, the phrase the big lie is a phrase normally used to refer to a Nazi propaganda technique. So you are clearly very worried about a rollback in this process of integration, even though you do say that it has gone a very long way and has produced great benefit. So my question is, do you still think today, 2006, that there is a great danger of this process rolling back. And who exactly is it that you think constitute the enemies gathering outside and inside the gates?
Nearly as good as the letter, that one, I thought. Right?
over to you.
That's another half hour. as you know, Robert, since you are such an attentive reader and critic,
we noticed.
I think you know my book better than I do, which is frightening. Which is frightening. My view of the history here is that, and I think on this at least we would probably agree, there are a few things we agree, that there was a process of liberalisation in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, much more limited, of course, deeply vitiated by imperialism, that's perfectly obvious, but nonetheless one which did expand prosperity very considerably from where it started. One of the great, most successful economies at that time, interestingly, was Russia's. This was a process that many people believed would continue and expand and lead to a cosmopolitan order of some kind. It was shattered between 1914 and 1945 completely. And that seems to me to serve as a fairly major warning. And most people would agree, whether you're, as it were, looking at this order from a social democrat, indeed my book is specifically addressed to social democrats, suggesting they should agree with much of my argument, or liberals, that the result of that, what happened in that period, was a total catastrophe. Now, my argument in the book, and here I think I probably do agree with critics, there are people who disagree with me, possibly David and you, who would agree with this, is that there are a range of forces that one can identify as destroying the commitment to a broadly cooperative and liberal order, which I think is what we are trying to defend, and on which actually I don't think there's such a terribly deep disagreement. And what are those forces? Resurgent nationalism, great power rivalries, radical strategic insecurity, the breakdown of the belief in a society that liberalism is, as it were, sufficiently beneficial to all. In other words, enormous changes in internal income distribution, and protectionism associated with that, economic breakdown, and of course a whole host of people who seize upon these opportunities to put forward, as they did then, utopian ideologies of politics of both the left and the right. So those dangers seem to me just a permanent feature of humanity, and in the present situation, for reasons I've written in both the book and also in columns, it's pretty obvious that all these, or most of these dangers, are extremely present. And I would stress, in fact, quite particularly, the great power rivalries, insecurities, strategic insecurities, dangers. But there are no doubt others. Maintaining a liberal and cooperative order, which I think is in the benefit of all, is always hard because, very deep sense, it doesn't seem to me to be a natural thing for us to manage at the global level.
Thanks very much. I'll take two questions. There's a lady in red and there's a gentleman at the back then. Anybody up there, I'll take from the... yeah, please.
I'm concerned that you've managed to go through the whole world and everything, both the speakers, in fact, without mention of gender or women whatsoever, when it could easily be said that the whole of world trade runs on women's free reproductive labour and the universal gender pay gap, and including the economic miracles you're talking about were on women's cheap labour. Your references to your concern about population, again, is an issue of women's disadvantage. And in fact, Professor Held's references to social democracy, that a major difference there is that there are places where women actually have more rights. So it seems to me it's a pretty huge issue that hasn't been mentioned. And the fact, Martin Wolf, that you don't refer to China's economic growth, the fact that it's based on a socialist system, I'll consider a minor point.
Thanks. So I'm going to take a block, if I could. There's a gentleman there, back there. Yeah. Anybody up the top there? Who's got the mic up the top? Somebody over here with the blue arm, mobile arm. Okay. Yeah, please.
Mr. Wolf, let's see if I can deal with a couple of points.
Yeah.
Would you agree that globalization might be defined as the removal of all legal and administrative impediments to the movement of capital? That might be one good, short, brief definition of globalization. following on from that, would you agree that globalization, as we have it at present, is essentially a top-down phenomenon? It's essentially promoted by the senior tier of politicians and administrators in government, business, and academia. Okay? The mood seems to be that we don't know any longer how to build the good society, but we know how to pursue our own interests, so let's have a system that gives us unlimited freedom to pursue our own interests. Would you agree that the model of globalization you advocate, the free exchange of goods between legal and political jurisdictions, takes no account of and does not respect the ordinary citizen's general interest in the goods being exchanged? The model is that each person owns a portfolio of goods which they have absolute title to. They can exchange those goods with anyone else in the world. No one else within a particular legal or political jurisdiction can claim to have any interest in the goods being exchanged. One little, just brief point.
That's a five-point question.
Reminds
me of the Cold War.
This is a very closely related point, and I shall make it very, very briefly.
Very, very brief.
Yeah.
Two words.
States have traditionally been collections of administrative institutional instrumentalities for regulating and controlling the use made of capital. If we have completely free movement of capital, what are states for?
Right, I get that. Right, there's a question up there. Yeah, the man with the mauve arm.
Hi, this is a question to Martin Wolf. Would you say that there's, given the order of world trade today, would you say there's ever any justification for protectionism? Especially considering, I've read an article by Dr. Roberts, who was a former assistant economics analyst at the Wall Street Journal, and also a former treasurer in the Reagan administration. And he argues that because at the time when Ricardo made his theory of comparative advantage, capital was much less mobile than goods and services. But now you have goods and services are less mobile than capital. And he argues that given this situation, you can actually, by removing tariffs, you actually make one country absolutely worse off, and you're taking advantage of absolute advantage as opposed to comparative advantage. And I believe Professor Samuelson also did some work on this a couple of years ago, and I was just wondering whether you had any comments on this.
I'm going to take one final one there, lady in green in the middle there. Yeah.
Thanks. It's a question on the press and media industry.
Sorry, you have to speak up because the acoustics in here, yeah, please.
It's a question on the press and media industry.
Okay.
New Labour and the press industry are justifying current deregulation on the grounds of globalisation. So is there a case for press ownership regulation to protect diversity? And to stop cross promotion between newspapers and TVs, etc. Thanks.
Okay, I think we'll end there. Well, on the questions, I think we've got quite a lot of answers to come. Perhaps Martin, why don't you take it first? And also, any final comments you want to make? Because I think we're going to do things soon. Okay, Martin.
I agree with everything the lady says about gender issues.
may be surprised.
Use the mic.
Sorry. And
he agreed with you.
I agreed with you. Mm. I didn't. I think they are enormously important. Maybe I should have made more of them in this relatively brief presentation, but it wasn't quite clear to me, and it still isn't quite clear how I would do so. I would just, however, mention that one of the points I do make, which I suspect you will disagree with very strongly, is that, I may be wrong, that the there are quite a number of interesting cases. I cite Bangladesh as one example in which the increased opportunities for income in export industries seem to have provided very significant benefits in terms of freedom and autonomy, for greater freedom and autonomy within the household of for women. But I agree it's probably the biggest single policy issue in the world. Second, I do not agree with the proposition that globalization could be defined as the elimination of controls on capital. It's a very Marxist position. I would associate it with the reduction of barriers, as I said, to the movement of goods, services, capital, and labor, and I discuss all of them as possibilities. And we can certainly have greater globalization without liberalization of capital movement. The political economy of the movement towards globalization seems to me vastly more complicated than you describe. I'm happy to discuss what happened in a whole range of individual countries and why the policymakers decided to move in this direction, rightly or wrongly. And it doesn't seem to me obvious that one can describe the only role of the state as controlling or suppressing capital. Well, if you include people in capital, the human capital as in capital, land which is not normally included in capital, I mean, if you include, in other words, everything that exists within the state, then it's true by definition. But otherwise, it doesn't seem to me to be correct. Paul Craig Roberts is wrong. He's always been wrong. He was wrong as a supply-sider, and he's wrong analytically now. Paul Samuelson's, I think there are arguments for protection, and sometimes it's the best, second, or third best policy, but I'm not at all persuaded that capital mobility changes this argument in general. Capital mobility can make, as I argue in the book, the problem of protectionism vastly worse, because it encourages tariff jumping, inward investment, which is purely exploitative and an absolute catastrophe, which whole hosts of developing countries did. Paul Samuelson's argument demonstrated that it is perfectly possible for countries to lose in a world in which everybody moves to integration, to liberalization. That is correct. It doesn't follow from that that a country will be better off than it would otherwise be, given what everybody else is doing, by moving to protection. It's a very important analytical distinction. Finally, on the press and media industry, I'm strongly in favor of, and I believe it is perfectly possible to have, restrictions on cross-media ownership. And if I were remaking competition policy in this country, I would make that much tougher than it is now, and I don't see at all why globalization makes this necessary. This is a point on which perhaps David and I will agree, because it does seem to me fairly obvious that the press and media perform functions within a society which are different from the providers of baked beans.
Okay. David.
Well, since time is running out, I'll just say yes, no, 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 because that was three questions, yes and yes. Or to put the point differently...
No, no, yes, yes, and no.
And in reverse order, I mean, I do agree with Martin on the issue of press. I think there is strong justification to treat the press differently. I think Canada is a very interesting country in this respect, that has both maintained open borders with the United States for the movement of ideas, press, media developments, but at the same time has nurtured Canada as a creative center for writing, media production, and so on. So in that sense, I think Canada is a very interesting example that provides good reasons and justifications for caution in this area. Obviously enough, I would be more sympathetic to arguments for selective protectionism than Martin. I think protectionism has a strategic and tactical role in the development of countries. Sometimes strategy lasts a long time, but in the development and nurturing of industries in worlds of very intensive global markets, it seems to me without certain special incentives within certain countries, certain economies will not develop at all. On the issue of the definitions of globalization, I just take a completely different view to the person who asked that question. For me, actually, globalization is a fairly empty category. It's a spatial category. It's about space. People lived in localities. They lived in larger areas. They live in, potentially live in processes that cross the global domain. It's a category of space. What fills it are the processes that we need to analyze: economics, politics, law, culture, and communications. For me, globalization, and to talk about the global, is not just capital-related or economic-related, because there are many processes, migration, communications, legal change, and so on, which exemplify elements of the processes we refer to as the stretching and intensification of human activity over space and time, or to use that word, globalization. And finally, on gender, gender is clearly critical. It's critical in the analysis of large global processes, and it's critical in the solution to most of the key issues. Take AIDS, HIV, it's absolutely self-evident that some of the most important differences between the agencies I referred to earlier are differences on gender. The G1 taking, it's my view, contradictory positions. On the one hand, the G1 opening up vast resources to support anti-HIV AIDS drugs, antiviral drugs in sub-Saharan Africa, at the same time campaigning to prevent distribution of condoms and so on. This is a position that attacks women because it means that women become even more vulnerable to the spread of the infection. So in each and every one area, there is a story, an important story to be told about gender. And yet, having said that, and that's, I think that's clear in most of my writings, I wouldn't say that just as Islam isn't an explanatory category, because behind it there are many different kinds of Islams and so on, I think gender isn't simply a single explanatory category either. It has to do particular work in particular contexts, and so one can't just simply be in favor of it or not in favor of it. It depends on the explanatory, normative, and policy question.
Thank you very much, David. At the beginning of this, the wolf on my right called himself a bull. And if this was a proper bullfight, of course, we'd have cut off his ears and dragged the carcass outside. But at LSE, we're far more civilized than that. The bull goes home. Not only does he go home, we also take him out for dinner afterwards. I would like to make a number of thanks. Firstly, I'd like to thank, and they don't get thanked often enough in public, is the LSE public events people, particularly Alan Revell and Shona McFarlane, if I may say thank you to them. Having taught and at other universities, I can say that the one thing that the LSE does far better than anybody else is its public events. It has a commitment to public debate, to public discussion, but behind that lies an enormous and great organization called our public events. So I'd like to thank them very much. Secondly, it follows from the nature of this talk tonight to thank the Miliband family and the organizers of this great event this evening. So thank you very much. And finally, thank you to our two speakers. I said at the very beginning that since 9/11, many people have proclaimed the death of globalization and the end of the globalization debate. If David and Martin tonight have proven anything, it is alive and well, and long may it continue. Thank you very much, and I hope you've had a very nice evening.